Welcome to this ICIS Chemicals podcast. I'm Will Beecham. Well, the chemical industry is stuck in the vice-like grip of two unstoppable forces. On the one side, fundamental changes in patterns of demand are altering the requirements of customers. On the other hand, possibly a permanent collapse in demand for transport fuels is forcing refiners to close or convert around the world. And this means less petrochemical feedstock for chemicals. With me to discuss how the industry can adapt to these new forces, I'm joined by Paul Hodges, who's chairman of New Normal Consulting, and delighted to welcome this week Rhiann O'Connor, who's our lead analyst for demand modelling. But first, there's been more good news about vaccines this week, with AstraZeneca revealing a 70 to 90% success rate for its product. And with the prospect of widespread vaccinations now from spring 2021, looking more likely, should we be feeling more optimistic about the global economy? What impact could there be on demand for things like polypropylene as hundreds of millions of the vaccines are manufactured and packed? Rhiann, maybe if I could start with you to get your views. Well, we're in the midst of a second wave of lockdowns. So how optimistic are you feeling about the economy and demand for chemicals bouncing back as the vaccines come into play?
Well, the good news is that this wave of lockdowns has not impacted the economy or chemicals demand nearly as badly as the first one. In essence, these lockdowns across Europe have been much more social and much less economic, with manufacturing facilities remaining open, with consumers continuing to buy, and with supply chains much more normalised than they were during the first lockdown. People are still buying, but they're buying online or using click and collect methodology to go to the store and pick it up there. The real problem is what happens when the lockdowns roll off, whether governments decide to tighten fiscal or monetary policy at that point. And Christine Lagarde said at a recent ECB policy meeting that continued powerful and targeted policy response was vital to protect the economy. If unemployment starts to rise as governments take away support, or as governments even start to increase taxes or loosen monetary policy, you will see demand for chemicals starting to falter into the new year.
Yeah, I mean, I think the UK government talking about needing to tighten up on fiscal policy next year sometime. So Paul, before we discuss more fundamental changes in chemical markets, what's your outlook for demand in the near term, say for Q4 and into 2021?
I think demand is going to be pretty hard to model, and I have great admiration for Rhiann in the work that she does in this area. And the reason is that you've got different waves of COVID hitting the economy at different times. And because of the globalized system that we have of manufacturing, actually starting to disappear now, but it's still there in various places, you see different acts at different times. I look at the example of TDI, for example, where we've had some plant outages, and as a result, in some parts of the world, in Europe, the TDI price, I think, has more or less doubled, whereas it's gone up 10% somewhere else. And that's merely because of shortages due to plant and supply problems. You know, if you go back to the auto industry in the States, almost every main factory supplying the US car industry was impacted by COVID. And so you get two reactions from that. One is that you don't have any product because the factory wasn't working. But secondly, when the factory does come back, you order like mad in order to keep your supplies there just in case you need it. So it's very hard, I think. You know, normally at this time of year, we'd be saying, well, people are going to reduce inventory for year end and so on. I doubt they're going to be doing that. So we're going to see a good, I think, run to the end of the year. Does that mean we'll have a lower lower set of demand in the new year? Well, maybe. I think it's about the best we've got. You know, key thing is we've got to remain flexible. We're in an unknown world here, and the key, whenever I talk to people in the industry, is they say, look, we don't know what's going to happen at the end of the month. So yeah, there's no point in, you know, we just have to run on the basis of what we know. And I think that's a very good outlook.
Yeah, there's very little visibility, that's for sure. Just looking at the vaccine, I was just looking on the internet to try and find out what kind of products go into the vaccine packaging. And I could see that a normal vial, you know, and the packaging has got quite a lot of polypropylene in it. So I wonder, Rhianne, whether you think that there'll be any kind of boost to polypropylene demand next year from as these hundreds of millions of vaccines are rolled out.
I mean, sure, it's an attractive application for polypropylene, but three points really. I mean, first of all, the actual grams of polypropylene in a vial, probably 2 to 3 grams, don't really compare with what's been lost in major applications like automotive and electronics and textiles. So we haven't really replaced all that lost demand with this. The second thing is about timing. I mean, a lot of these companies that make the pre-packaged vials started doing so earlier this year. It's obvious that a vaccine has been on the way and that it's easy to stockpile a pre-packaged polypropylene vial. So they've been doing so since the summer. So we're not going to see a big kick up in demand. My third concern is really around temperature. The Pfizer vaccine in particular needs to be stored at -70°C, so either on dry ice or in a very industrial freezer. And polypropylene just won't stand up to those kind of temperature pressures. It becomes brittle. Obviously, other vaccines like the Moderna or the Oxford AstraZeneca one can be stored in a normal fridge, but not all vaccines will be able to use polypropylene in their packaging.
Thank you. And Paul, what kind of other logistical kind of challenges are there for manufacturing and distributing these vaccines?
Well, I think the interesting thing is that the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine, they thought about all of these issues when they were starting. And they started early, as we know. I mean, they started right at the beginning of January. And they realised that this was the pandemic. But they had planned. But I think this is really interesting for companies, because I think it marks how we're going to run in the future. They already knew, as government should have known, that a pandemic was going to come. They already knew what the basis of the pandemic was going to be, because they'd had MERS and so on. And so they built the preparations for the vaccine even before it appeared. Once they saw it happening, and you know, China revealed details of it on the 31st of January, 31st of December, and revealed the DNA makeup in on the 11th of January, at that point they went to work. But they'd already gone to work to say, we're going to need this to be low cost and very easy to transport, because we're going to need to do 3 billion shots. And Bill Gates came in, of course, and working with the Serum Institute in India, who people don't always know about, but they're the biggest manufacturer of vaccines in the world. And he needed, in the summer, the money to get that off the ground. And the whole point has been to keep the cost as low as possible and to keep it as easy as possible to move it. And this is very different. I mean, I applaud AstraZeneca and Oxford on this. I mean, AstraZeneca always goes back to my old company, ICI. And you know, the difference is that with Pfizer, they simply went for whatever it was and said, well, if that's the cost, that's the cost. And if it's that difficult, and so on. They didn't take into account that critical element. So I'm very encouraged by this. And I think Bill Gates has done a fantastic job in this area. You know, he's already been involved in vaccines before, so he knew how to do it there. I'm sure with President Biden in charge, that the states will do what it normally does, which is to step up and make sure that there is access across the world for the people who need it. So I think this is after a terrible period, obviously, and this is going to go on for another 3 or 6 months at least in most countries, maybe longer, because just a big job to do it. This is going to be an example of how we should be operating in the new normal world.
Talking about new normal, well, looking sort of longer term, the industry is being squeezed between fundamental changes in demand patterns and a reduction in availability of petrochemical feedstocks. Paul, what kind of changes to demand patterns do you expect to see in the longer term? We're seeing big changes in automotive markets already, for example.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we're at the point now where I think it's very hard to argue that we're going to go back to where we were before, that the environmental genie, if you like, is out of the bottle and isn't going to go back in again. And, you know, we're seeing now, the key thing I think that's happening now that really must make the chemical industry sit up and take notice is the closure of refineries and the closures of major, very cost-effective refineries, like the Shell Convent refinery in Louisiana, which is going to close next week. There is not going to be a lot of oil processed through refineries. You know, Shell said, we had 55 refineries 15 years ago, we've got 17 at the moment, and we're now going to 6. And other companies are doing the same. So if you think that in 5 years' time, you're still going to be able to manufacture chemicals based on naphtha from refineries, well, you're going to have to hunt around like mad to find it, and you're going to have to pay a very high price. So the core value proposition isn't there. So you've got to move now. You've got to move to recycled product, and you've got to now do what you should have been done before, and some companies did, after all, which is to get your team together and say, look, these are the problems with sorting out this issue, solve them for me. The issue, of course, now is that we haven't got very long. We've only got 6 or 9 months. So because if the industry, once the electric vehicles are set up in volume and they start to run, it's going to be very difficult to persuade GM and VW and everybody else to change their patterns. So you've got to get in now. Similarly with the brand owners. Either you start to move very fast with recycled plastics and so on, so they can meet their commitments to the consumer, or they will move to cardboard, metal, or whatever. And I know that those are worse for the CO2 emissions and so on. Everybody knows that, but that's not the point. The customer does not want plastic waste. And as my butcher has a little sign above his counter that says, you never win an argument with a customer. So let's forget about all this, oh, but it would be, because the customer isn't interested. That's not her story. What her story is I don't want this plastic waste. So we have to solve that. And this is going to be a fantastic opportunity for the companies that make the leap. Really is. It's going to be another 50 years of fabulous growth in revenue and profit. So I just hope we now get on with it.
Rhian, what kind of changes in demand patterns do you foresee in the markets that you cover?
It's really interesting because you still get a lot of people forecasting plastic demand based on things like GDP per capita. And our approach is stepping away from that and looking at which markets they're going into. So I agree with Paul completely that packaging is on a steady path in decline. Obviously had a kick up in the pandemic as people prioritised health and hygiene, but we're still getting brands swapping out of using plastic or certainly using more complex plastics and increasing their recycled and recyclable content. And I think that's going to continue. And I also agree with Paul that automotive trends are pretty negative. We're going to see less people driving. If they are driving, they are going to be driving increasingly electric vehicles. But in urban environments, we're going to be moving much more onto public transport, onto bicycles, onto electric scooters, onto ride-sharing apps, and even in the future, self-driving or autonomous vehicles. So I think that the car as we know it is certainly going to change its plastic content. And the modelling we are doing is taking all of these trends into account and looking at each market individually and how that is going to change with time.
I'm just wondering if I could ask both of you on this. How quickly do you think this change is going to come about in terms of the switch to recycled feedstocks or the switch to recycled polymers or other types of chemicals? Is it imminent or could it take 5 or 10 years? Rhian, would you like to have a go at that one?
Sure. I mean, it's evolutionary, not revolutionary. There's no step change. We are doing this and we are doing it constantly. And obviously the Single Plastics Directive is coming in Europe, or has come in already in Europe. That is fairly small scale, but brands are pushing even beyond that and doing more than they're being asked to do. So it's just going to continue year after year, much simpler plastics and much more recycled and recyclable. Of course, the limit is how much food grade recyclable polymer is available. You know, a PET bottle can only be recycled 3 times before it has to be recycled into a lower grade application like a fiber. And brands are really struggling to get enough food grade recycled polymer. So that whole collection system is going to have to be sorted as well. And that's really where the roadblock is right now.
Yeah, so capacity is the big issue, isn't it? And infrastructure. Paul, how quickly do you think things are going to change?
These things always operate on an S-curve, and incumbents always do what the industry has done, which is to say, oh, I told you it was a load of rubbish, never work in the world, nobody wants that kind of nonsense, and so on. And then suddenly the business model becomes clearer and you go up the S-curve and you go incredibly fast. And the thing that I think we can now sit back and watch is the change in the States. That I've worked in the States, you know, I love the States, and you know that States, because it's a very, very large country, it tends to look inwards a lot of the time. And then one day it looks over its shoulder, something happens. And in this case, the something happens is the Biden administration, and companies go, hey, wait a minute, that's what we should do. And everybody else goes, hey, wait a minute, what happened here? What? And the States will go incredibly fast now in this area. All the people who were telling you, no, will suddenly tell you, no, of course we're going to do that. Of course we are. And they will set their best people at it, and they will come up with the solutions. And, you know, they know, you know, Biden knows that the States is behind Europe and China in this. And he knows that the Green Revolution is going to be the jobs and the industries of the future. He said that very clearly. It's his top priority, along with COVID. So he's got to get on with it, and America will. So we're suddenly going to see, and this is the key to it. Up till now, we've had people telling us why you can't do it. That's going to be irrelevant now. But now, the question is, how do you do it? And it's going to be a wonderful time for techno-commercial people, for commercial people, for business people, because suddenly we're going to be doing what we do best, which is finding solutions to real problems. It's going to be a great time to be around.
So Paul, you're sounding very, very optimistic. And finally, Donald Trump almost conceded defeat yesterday, not quite. So Paul, what do you think Joe Biden's appointments could mean for policies which would affect the chemical industry? You've already mentioned the Green Revolution.
Well, I think that he's set out, you know, his top four policies. Obviously, COVID is top. The economy is there, and the issue that we've got is Trump hollowed out large parts of the administration, so there aren't necessarily all the experienced experts there to implement policy, but I suspect quite a lot of them will come back fairly quickly. And, you know, it's been a bit of a wake-up call for the rest of the world, I think. I think we've always kind of, outside of the States, we've always kind of liked the idea of having American leadership, but it's always been there, so you can kick about it. Oh, we don't know, so on. Well, I think people have realised after 4 years, you know, it's really nice having American leadership. Yes, please. Thank you very much. And the way that, you know, world leaders in the democratic countries lined up to call and congratulate Biden even before Trump had allowed the GAO to go forward, I think that showed you the enormous goodwill that there is here. And I'm very encouraged about this. We just have to get through to January the 20th. I hope there's no more hiccups on the road. And, you know, it's going to be a difficult time, obviously. Next year is going to be very difficult to, you know, because the economy is bad, the pandemic is still going, there is light at the end of the tunnel. But let's face it, we're in a lot better position than we could have been.
So, Rianne, I'm just thinking about international affairs. It's going to be a big change there. And I just wondered whether you think this could improve things for chemical markets. I mean, could, for example, could the US now become, see China as a better export market for US products?
I mean, certainly America's relationships with China will not get worse. And we may see a rollback of some of the trade restrictions and tariffs that have built up between the two nations. But nothing fundamental is going to change really between the relationship. I mean, the US and China will still remain suspicious of each other under Biden. And to stand up to China, Biden is going to have to forge relationships with other nations, particularly Asian partners like Japan or Korea, but also European partners too. And GDP will improve for both China, America and other nations too.
Brianna and Paul, thank you both very much for joining me today. And if you'd like to learn more about the products and services that we have on offer, visit icis.com.